Welcome to Earth Matters Now. This is Laura Ackerman, and you are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 and 92.3 FM. It's Tuesday, June 4th at noon. We are now an hour-long show, and Counterspin has moved to 4 p.m. on Wednesdays. In a few minutes, we will be speaking with Maya Van Rossum, the Delaware Riverkeeper and author of the book, The Green Amendment.
And this is Mike Peterson. Our views don't necessarily represent those of KORS or our underwriter. I want to thank Tom Angel, Architect AIA, creating healthy and sustainable solutions for your home, business, and community projects. Information is available at 747-7647 or Tom at TomAngel.com. We also receive support from the Community Building Foundation, empowering local organizations to help our community experience justice, vibrancy, and sustainability. In the weather, it's going to be highs in the 70s this week with some possible showers over the weekend.
I would like to welcome Maya Van Rossum to Earth Matters Now and to Spokane.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Maya is a veteran, environmentalist, a lawyer, and the Delaware Riverkeeper. And in her new book, The Green Amendment, she lays out an inspiring new agenda for environmental advocacy, one that will empower people, level the playing field, and provide real hope for communities everywhere. The book provides a logical framework for change that is changing the 50 states and the federal constitution to include the right to clean air and water for all citizens. And Maya, first, let's just talk about how you got started, because you grew up in the Delaware watershed.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And how did you went to law school, but how did you end up being the Delaware Riverkeeper?
So I went to law school not because I wanted to be an environmental attorney, but because I wanted to be a better environmental advocate. And I saw the law as an important tool for accomplishing that. And truth be told, the universe smiled upon me, and I had a pretty direct path from law school to then getting a master's of law degree and working at an environmental law clinic for 2 years, and then going pretty quickly to work at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and taking over that very young organization that was struggling at the time. And that was back in 1994. So 25 years I've been the Delaware Riverkeeper. And like I said, the universe just smiled on me and put me where I think I needed to be.
Just tell us a little bit about the Delaware River.
So the Delaware River is a beautiful river. I will say I went for a lovely run this morning along the Spokane River, and that was beautiful too. But the Delaware River is 330 miles long. It includes, its watershed includes portions of four states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. The upper reaches are relatively rural and naturalized, particularly because the Delaware River is the drinking water supply for over 15 million people. And one of the ways the state of New York and New York City have worked to preserve the quality of their drinking water is to preserve the natural health of the upper Delaware River watershed, because they recognize very early on that by protecting the environment, you would best protect your waterways. So the upper reaches of the watershed are very rural. As you flow down the river, you find more and more cities, so it becomes more industrialized. And then you end up in the Delaware Bay, where you have sort of lovely ocean-like beaches. But the Delaware River is free-flowing for the entire 330-mile length of the main stem. Last major free-flowing river on the East Coast.
So how did that happen?
It happened because of people. There had actually been a major dam proposal, flood control dam, for the main stem river, and communities got together and battled against it because they recognized the power and importance ecologically and economically and recreationally of a free-flowing river. And so battled for many, many years to prevent construction of the Tox Island Dam, and were successful. So it happened because people cared and recognized that a healthy river and a healthy environment are, you know, what's essential for all of our communities, and that a dam really impedes that.
Well, let's get into a little bit of, you're on a tour, and what is a green amendment anyway? Tell us what that is and why you're leading this effort.
So a green amendment is a provision that is placed in the Bill of Rights section of the Constitution that recognizes and protects the inalienable right to clean water, clean air, a stable climate, and a healthy environment, and protects, recognizes and protects those rights in the same way we recognize and protect the other fundamental freedoms we hold dear, like the right to free speech, the right to freedom of religion, private property rights, due process rights are just some really good examples. There are only two states across the nation that have a Green Amendment of this kind. That's Pennsylvania and Montana. And the reason why we have won a meaningful Green Amendment in Pennsylvania, why I wrote the book and why I'm leading this national Green Amendments for the Generations movement, is because the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, while it had really good Green Amendment language in the Bill of Rights section of the state constitution since 1971, very quickly, because of really a misuse, an effort to misuse that Green Amendment very early on, we got court decisions out of the Pennsylvania courts, including the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that declared the language of the Green Amendment to be good public policy, but not to have the same legal strength as all of the other provisions in the Bill of Rights section of the state constitution. And so for 42 years, we had this amazing language on the books in the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but it did nothing to change environmental protection in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Fast forward to 2012, when a very pro-fracking piece of legislation was passed by the Pennsylvania legislature that was going to take an already devastating industry and just magnify tremendously its footprint and its harms on Pennsylvania communities and environments. We at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network realized that maybe we were in a moment in time when we could use this Green Amendment to challenge this devastating legislation and literally breathe legal life back into the amendment. And we were successful. And in December of 2013, we got a decision out of a very conservative Pennsylvania Supreme Court that declared unconstitutional the most devastating elements of this pro-fracking piece of legislation and used Pennsylvania's Green Amendment as the fundamental basis for that determination that the provisions were unconstitutional. So we defeated these devastating aspects of the law, breathed legal life back into the Green Amendment, restored to the people of Pennsylvania their constitutional right to a healthy environment. And pretty quickly for me, I realized and recognized what a powerful environmental protection tool this truly was, and embarked on the effort of finding out what was the status of constitutional environmental rights in states across the nation, realized it was Pennsylvania, Montana, and decided that it was time to change that. So I wrote the Green Amendment and have created this new national movement called Green Amendments for the Generations, and I'm trying to get communities in every state across the nation to advance the passage of a Green Amendment in all of our state constitutions first. And then as a result of that effort, ultimately, we will be in the right place to advance a federal Green Amendment. But we have to begin with the states first. Strategically, that is fundamentally important.
And I think I want to address that fundamental importance. But I just want you to briefly talk about Montana, because it's so close to where we are, and I worked with, in my energy work, with a lot of people in Montana. The Powder River Basin is there. You know, coal is shipped from there through Washington. What happened in Montana that they ended up with a Green Amendment?
So, you know, Montana, Pennsylvania, and states across the nation, frankly, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, we had this wonderful environmental awakening, right, in many states across the nation. That's right. And at that time, we actually had a lot of activity at the state level to add language to our state constitutions about the environment, about environmental protection, even about environmental rights. But only Pennsylvania and Montana did it the right way, at least what I call the right way, in having this provision that was self-executing, meaning that you don't have to have laws to give it legal life, right? That was self-executing, added to the Bill of Rights section, talking about the fundamental human right to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. In Montana, in the early 1990s, we had an incredibly successful legal challenge against the gold mining operations by the MEIC. That's an organization in Montana that led that legal battle and demonstrated the power of a green amendment in the state of constitution, and that this devastating gold mining operation actually had its approved permit taken away because it was going to have such devastating impacts on the environment. A few years after that, there was a very powerful decision in the state of Montana where there was going to be a threat to a drinking water supply by a proposed development. And long story short, this proposed development, if it had been allowed to advance the way the developer wanted it and had agreed to with the landowner, there was going to be the potential of contaminating with toxic contamination the drinking water supply of an entire community. And Montana's Green Amendment was used to prevent the enforcement of a contract with the developer that would have allowed that major drinking water threat, right? So it was very powerful there. And then, truth be told, when, you know, in my research for the book, didn't see a too much more action and activity, bits here and there that were important, but not those really big, hard-hitting victories, until last month, when last month the Green Amendment was used again to protect communities from a gold mining operation and the implementation of a law, the passage of a piece of legislation that would have allowed this devastating mining operation to proceed while concerned citizens were trying to challenge it in the courts. And essentially what this law said was that the agencies could not put on hold an approved project while it was being challenged in the courts, despite the fact that we knew that there would be these devastating impacts, and that because of a couple of provisions of the state constitution, that it was unconstitutional and illegal to allow this devastating project to advance to prevent the regulatory agency from putting it on hold while these citizens, these communities challenged the project. The reason being is that even though the communities would be victorious because of this pre-existing law, that victory would have come after all of the devastation had been inflicted. The courts just said that's wrong.
And so that was just very recently in Montana.
That was just last month. So what I'm hoping, and from where I'm sitting, what I hope we're seeing is a resurgence in the state of Montana to fully embrace the power of their Green Amendment, while folks in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania are re-embracing the power of the Pennsylvania Green Amendment and are really going to be helping to demonstrate to communities across the nation that it really matters to have a Green Amendment added to the Bill of Rights section of your state constitution. This is not just pretty language that sounds good that we can all cite when we testify, you know, at hearings and then can be ignored by our legislators and decision makers. This is powerful language that is necessary for protecting our human right to access clean water, clean air, a healthy environment, and I believe also to secure a stable climate.
So there's other states that are really more progressive in a way than Montana or Pennsylvania throughout the West and the East Coast. What's going on there, and what are your efforts there?
So it is so interesting, right, that we do have Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Montana being the states with this powerful progressive Green Amendment language in their constitutions. And then, as you said, we have so many other states across the nation that are much more progressive environmentally. But what we see in those other states is that they either have no language in their constitutions about the environment, nothing, or in the majority of situations, actually, we have over 40 states that actually talk about the environment in their constitutions, right? But they don't include that language in the Bill of Rights section of their constitution. They talk about it lower down in the constitution where it's not recognized as an inalienable or fundamental right. And they might use beautiful language about the right to clean water and clean air, but they either begin or end the sentence with, And that's good public policy. Or the way you get that is that your legislature passes environmental protection laws. Well, if your legislature passes environmental protection laws that don't protect your environment, that does nothing for you, that language. And then there are a few states that actually have language in the Bill of Rights section of their Constitution, but they talk about the right to fish, hunt, or trap. Mm-hmm. They don't talk about the inalienable mm-hmm. right to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. So consequently, we actually have a lot of states that talk about the environment in their constitutions, but not in the legally, constitutionally meaningful ways that Pennsylvania and Montana do, and that we need to recognize and protect our rights to a healthy environment as a fundamental, inalienable human right.
So that leads to the question of all the environmental laws that we do have. As you well know, you're a lawyer, you're an environmental lawyer, you know what all the laws are at the national level, you know, clean water, clean air, you know, MATCA, CERCLA, etc. And in this state, in Washington, because we're a progressive state, we have the State Environmental Policy Act, which has been extremely helpful. What do you see as the problem with all those environmental laws as opposed to a green amendment? What would that do for us let's just say we take the state of Washington because we're progressive and because we have the Growth Management Act in this state as well. And few states have that. We have a Shorelines Management Act. Isn't that enough? And if so, why not?
Well, we know it's not enough because we can just look at the state of our environment in Washington and in states across the nation. And we have people that are drinking contaminated water, mm-hmm. breathing contaminated air. We have species that continue to be brought to the brink of extinction, if not over the edge, right? So we can see just by looking at the landscape and what's happening in reality in communities in Washington across the nation, we can see that our current system of environmental protection laws is failing us. And it's failing us for two reasons, from the most progressive states to the least progressive states and at the federal level. Number one, there are a lot of areas that are not regulated or legislated on when it comes to the environment. If you mm-hmm. think about perfluorinated chemicals, PFOS, PFAS, mm-hmm. PFOA, right? For many, many years, including in many states today, this toxic family of chemicals was not regulated in any way mm-hmm. by state or federal law. And today, we continue to have federal regulators and state legislators in many states resistant to regulating this compound or the need to clean it up out of our drinking water supplies, out of our environment, despite the fact that we know that it's so prolific and that it is can cause cancer and all sorts of other health consequences. So, long story short, we have a lot of gaps. Right, there are a lot of things that aren't regulated, either the prevention of their use or once we find out that there's a problem, the obligation to actually affirmatively clean it up. And then where we do have laws, the way our legal system operates here in the United States of America is pollution, degradation, harm to our environment is accepted as a necessary evil, a foregone conclusion, something that we have to allow to happen, right, if we want to live a modern life. And so, therefore, our laws are written in a way that accepts pollution and degradation as a foregone conclusion and focuses on managing the how, the when, the where we will allow mm-hmm. it to happen through permits and permitting. They don't begin from the place of should it be allowed to happen in the first instance. If you have a properly framed, written, and applied green amendment, you actually end up in that place of should we allow pollution and degradation to happen first? That's the first question that must be considered under a properly written and applied green amendment. It's really an anti-degradation standard, right? It doesn't start from the place of it's a necessary evil, it's a foregone conclusion. It starts from the place, if we're going to accomplish energy creation, development, or whatever it is we're trying to accomplish, how can we do it in a way that avoids pollution and degradation first? Then a green amendment really mandates that government officials work to minimize the harm, right, in order to protect the constitutional right to a healthy environment. It mandates that government officials consider the impacts and the science of a decision before they act. they can't look at the implications of their decision, allowing some sort of chemical to be used or some sort of project to be advanced. They can't look at it, you know, after the fact, right? They have to be able to demonstrate under the law that they considered the science and the impacts first before their decision making. And if they can't make that showing, their decision cannot stand. And that we've had actually a number of cases in Pennsylvania where permits had to be pulled and decisions could not withstand legal scrutiny because the regulators could not demonstrate that they looked at the impacts before they rendered the decision or issued the permit. Environmental justice gets renewed vigor and power because now every single individual across the state has the same right to clean water, clean air, a stable climate, and a healthy environment. And government officials must recognize and protect that right equitably. You can no longer have environmental sacrifice zones. We're going to sacrifice this community in this more urban area in order to protect other communities where we still have, you know, greener spaces, because everybody has the same constitutional right, and our government officials are duty bound to protect the rights of all people in all communities equitably. So we really change the game when we have a constitutional right to a healthy environment.
So it seems like this would be, could be very effective at, you know, new projects, a new terminal, a new fracking project. In the case of the PFAS, we have an air base out here that is contaminated groundwater, and they, of course, discovered it after the fact. How would this help, do you think, for the people who are having to suffer around these air bases all around the country who are have their water contaminated? Would this kick in with existing pollution to clean it up better, or how would that work?
So we believe, again, that a properly framed and written Green Amendment actually brings with it the duty to restore the constitutional right to a healthy environment if it's already been lost. And so when you're talking about PFOS, right, there would be a duty to restore access to clean water and a healthy environment to those communities that are right now already suffering from contamination. And I'll just give you a concrete example, for lack of a better word. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we're actually dealing with a site that is super saturated with a different kind of toxin, a toxin known as TCE, trichloroethylene, that also has very serious health consequences for those who have the misfortune of coming into contact with it, let alone finding it in their drinking water or in the environments that they are in regular contact with. And there, we are continuing the battle to get that site cleaned up, but we actually have had a decision as a part of our effort to mandate that the government affirmatively act to clean up that site. They've known, just for a little bit of context, this site has been super saturated since at least the mid-80s, and the Pennsylvania government has been aware of it, and yet has taken no meaningful action to clean up the TCE at that site. And as a result, the pollution plume has spread more than a mile away from the site. We got a decision about a year ago, I believe, where the courts, using the constitutional language and framework, made clear that the right to a healthy environment brings with it the duty to restore. And so, you know, that's a different kind of contaminant, same kind of situation. And if you think about it, it makes sense. If we were to add a new constitutional provision, just pretend that there was no constitutional right to free speech or freedom of religion, right? And those provisions were newly added to the state constitution today. Would anybody accept the premise that, well, we're going to protect the right to freedom of religion and the right to freedom of speech moving forward, but all of the infringements on the constitutional right that continue today because of past actions and activities, well, we're going to allow them, those violations, those constitutional violations, to continue to stay in place? Nobody would accept that. Nobody would accept that in any other constitutional context. So we cannot accept that. We do not accept that. And we don't have to accept that when we're talking about adding a constitutional right to a healthy environment to our state constitutions.
But we clearly, people believe that. I mean, you know, you're familiar with the Northwest. We've got coal and oil export facilities, and I've been to a number of hearings, and people will say this is a jobs versus the environment thing, and I'm sorry, but jobs have to win. It's jobs at any cost. And how did that get manifested into our Constitution, in a way? Maybe it doesn't expressly say that, but there is this sort of very political realm, especially in the West, where it's like, yeah, that's just progress. I'm sorry, environmentalists, but you guys are kind of freaks, and jobs, you know, we can't let people not have electricity. I mean, is that a part of capitalism?
Well, I don't think I don't see it as part of capitalism, right? Because, I mean, we have so much evidence and so much experience that if you want to have healthy job creation and a healthy economy, you have to have a healthy environment. There's so much, right, demonstration of that reality. And in fact, in the book, I dedicate a whole chapter to it, right? If we actually go back to, right, I talked about how New York City protects their drinking water supply by protecting the upper reaches of the Delaware River watershed in a natural state, in a natural condition. Well, they do that because environmentally it makes sense and it's been beneficial to the Delaware River, but they also do that because economically it makes sense. The city of New York has invested about $1.5 billion in protecting the natural environments that are the Delaware River watershed and the source of their drinking water supply. And as a result, they have avoided spending over $10 billion in a new water treatment plant, water purification plant, that they would have otherwise had to construct in order to supply clean water to New York City. Because of the watershed protection work in the upper reaches of the Delaware River watershed, New York City drinks Delaware River water that is untreated. Right? It comes from that natural system. When you talk about energy creation, right, there's so much time and time again we have a demonstration that if for every $1 million invested in clean energy strategies, we create 3 to 5 times the number of jobs than if we invested that same amount of money in advancing dirty fossil fuels, whether you're talking about coal or fracked shale gas. When you talk about development, developing properties, residential communities in a way that is environmentally protective, reduce the cost of the development project, protects downstream communities from all the expense and harms that come with increasing flooding and flooding damages and water pollution, but also helps the developers to sell those homes more quickly for a much higher market rate than they would have otherwise. In other words, across the board, when you protect the environment, you protect the economy more firmly than you would otherwise.
Right, and people say that at hearings, but it falls on deaf ears in a lot of ways. And it's just sort of not a part of our capitalistic system, even though we have examples of that, and some people clearly do it. But, I mean, do you think in part we have this investment into the fossil fuel infrastructure, into this whole attitude that we have to have fossil fuels in order to have a civilization? Because I know you've worked on LNG stuff, a lot of that. I mean, how's the Green Amendment going to deal with all of this? How's that going to help that sort of economic response that people have? Like, no, we can't do this.
Right. So when you have a Green Amendment, when you have a constitutional right to a healthy environment, and again, we've demonstrated this through court decision making in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, those kinds of economic arguments, right, cannot be used to trump, for lack of a better word, to trump the constitutional right to a healthy environment. Economics, you take the environmental rights above that conversation, out of that conversation. It puts it on an entirely different playing field. The other thing that's really powerful to recognize, and I know you're cringing, but that is part of the reality, is under a legal constitutional framework, economic arguments cannot be used to displace the constitutional obligation to protect the environmental right. That's not the way, right? If you think, it's just the way constitutional law, constitutional principles operate. But the other thing, right, is right now one of the biggest tools that polluters, developers, energy operators have in their toolkit to advance their dirty operations is property rights. They say we have a constitutional right to use our property the way we see fit. Now, of course, there are limitations under the police powers. There have been some limitations that say, well, you can't use your property rights in a way that inflicts harms on the property rights of others. But nonetheless, property rights have constitutional Bill of Rights standing, and so it becomes an incredibly powerful tool for the developers and the energy operators and the industrial folks to use to advance their project, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And there is no counterbalance in the Constitution to that. If you have a Green Amendment with the constitutional rights, constitutional private property rights. And not only is it on par, right, but also, in fact, what we've seen in some of the Pennsylvania courts is because that constitutional right to a healthy environment has that, you know, broad community, everybody has those all those rights of all those peoples in the community are placed in the balance, that what the courts have said is that the Pennsylvania Green Amendment actually puts a thumb on the scale for the environment when you're talking about that tension between property rights and environmental rights. So it becomes an incredibly powerful legal tool to battle against the arguments that we must sacrifice the rights of people to access clean and healthy water and clean and healthy air in order to advance a dirty and industrial operation that because of economic arguments. It forces the conversation of looking at the other options and alternatives for how we create energy, how we advance development, how we advance our goals, right? The obligation of government becomes, how do we accomplish the goals that we're seeking to accomplish as a community, as government officials, in a way that protects the environment at the same time? It's no longer a question of, do we mine, do we frack or not? It becomes a question of, how do we create energy, right? Because we need to create energy in a way that protects the environment at the same time. So you've changed the playing field and you've changed the conversation legally and fundamentally from the get-go. And yes, it's going to be work, right? It's going to be work to carry this message forward. But, you know, we have to. And in my talks, I say all the time, it is never acceptable, constitutional, Green Amendment or not, it is never, ever acceptable to say that we will sacrifice the life of this family or this child in order to make an argument that we're going to create a job for somebody else. That is never an acceptable trade-off. And we must not, as people on this earth or as communities, ever allow that argument to win the day.
We're going to take a very short break, a station break. You're listening to Earth Matters Now on KYRS 88.1 and 92.3 FM. And help keep Earth Matters coming to you every week for as little as $3 a month by texting Give KYRS to 44321. We're speaking with Maya Van Rosen, and she is a Delaware Riverkeeper. And Maya, in your book, The Green Amendment, you give a number of pretty heartbreaking stories of people who have been poisoned by, you know, gas from natural gas facilities, have had contamination of their wells. Those things have helped motivate them to become activists, and you're clearly a, you know, a very strong-willed activist. What are you finding as you travel around the country? Are you finding any traction on getting legislation going?
Yes. Well, the Green Amendment movement is really starting to catch on. I'm very happy to say that since I've written the book and since I've been doing this, advancing this concept of a Green Amendment movement across the nation, we actually have 4 Green Amendment proposals that have been put forth. There's a Green Amendment proposal in the state of New York, one in the state of New Jersey. There has been a Green Amendment proposal in the state of Maryland. And most recently this year, there's a Green Amendment proposal that has been advanced in the state of West Virginia. And also as a result of my travels around the country, and I want to say, if you're in a community where you would like me to come speak about this issue to your community, just get in touch with me at maya@forthegenerations.org, and we will make arrangements to come to you. And I will do it on my dime, right? The goal is to save the world and to spread the message. The goal is not, right, to force people to pay money. And if you were to buy the book, every penny goes back to environmental protection. Not a penny goes to my pocket. That's important. But anyway, in where I've been doing these talks, right, we have an incredible level of interest. We have interest in Colorado, in Florida. I've been to Oregon a number of times. We have interest in Maine. And I'm hoping by doing the series of three talks in the state of Idaho in the next 3 days and being on your wonderful show today, I'm hoping that maybe we will inspire a community or organization to want to champion the advancement of a green amendment here in the state of Washington and also in neighboring Idaho. And the Green Amendments for the Generations organization is about making me available to come work with you to share the message of the power and importance of green amendments and to help develop and advance the strategy that would allow you to advance a green amendment in your state. It won't be easy anywhere. Don't get me wrong. I'm not thinking we're going to have green amendment proposals proposed today and passed tomorrow. Adding a constitutional provision to the Bill of Rights section of your state constitution, no matter where you are, no matter how progressive your state, will take work and will take time. But the beauty of that is once you are successful, it will also be incredibly difficult for somebody to take that constitutional right away from you.
So how do you compare having a green amendment with, say, giving particular rivers rights, like they're their own entity of sorts, or, you know, watersheds or forests? I mean, are they similar? If they are, how are they similar? How are they different?
So giving nature rights, right, the nature rights movement is not the same thing as the passage of a green amendment. They are not mutually exclusive, right? They can both be synergistic, value added to one another, but they are fundamentally different. So under our current system of laws in the United States of America, if you want to, under state law or under federal law, you want to champion environmental protection, right? Stop some damaging or polluting operation, some violation of a state or federal environmental protection law, you have to be able to show that there is a person, persons, communities that are being harmed. That's what gives you standing to get into the courtroom and to make the case that there has been a violation of the law that needs to be remedied. If you give rights to nature, if you have a rights of nature provision that were to pass, what you then are saying is that you don't have to find that person to stand up for and champion the rights of the environment, that person that's being personally harmed. All you have to demonstrate is that there has been harm to that river, harm to that creature or that forest, and then you can have attorneys demonstrate that there's been a violation of the law and seek enforcement. But the thing is if you accomplish that, you're still in this under the same limitation of the current environmental protection system we have. Nature could only advance enforcement of the laws that we have in place, right? To the extent that those laws provide for environmental protection. You haven't raised the bar in terms of the level of environmental protection you're going to provide. You haven't filled in all of the legislative gaps, which is what a green amendment does. You've simply made it easier to access the courts by demonstrating environmental harm, not having to find that person that will be able to give you standing. So it's a powerful and important concept, and I absolutely believe that rights of nature, I believe in that concept, I think it's important, but it in no way, shape, or form displaces the need for a green amendment and providing that higher level of recognition and protection for a right to a healthy environment. And in states like Oregon and Colorado, where they have a very active rights of nature movement already going, I have actually demonstrated to those communities how the rights of nature concept could actually be integrated into a constitutional green amendment. So you can actually marry the two concepts together. But to me, the more powerful, if you had to pick one, the more powerful is the green amendment proposal.
So we have a problem with PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, here in Spokane, as does most of the country. And we have very fairly strict standards for our river. And the city of Spokane actually is suing Monsanto and it's going to wind through the course for years and years. I just wonder how, if you had a green amendment, how could, would that make it easier to take on Monsanto for PCB production and glyphosate, which they're spewing all over our farmland? Do you think, how would that work?
So primarily a green amendment is a check on government action, right, and government activity. It's about preventing governments from doing things that will harm the environment, like permitting a new industrial operation that would, right, violate somebody's constitutional right to a healthy environment. Or again, in a situation where you have environmental degradation, ensuring that the government takes action and activities to restore access to the constitutional right to a healthy environment. A green amendment, well, now there, it depends on how it's written, but primarily a green amendment is not going to be used by an individual to go after Monsanto, right? It's going to be about making sure that government does the right thing to clean up the environment. Now, that being said, in the state of New Jersey, for example, when we've been talking about PFOS and PFOA and PFNA at very, very high levels in New Jersey communities and drinking water supplies, for many, many years, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network was advocating for, fighting for, drinking water standards that would protect people's drinking water supplies and mandate a level of cleanup by the water purveyors and or by the industries that cause the harm. Under Governor Christie, there was a real effort to stall putting in place those increased drinking water protections. We've overcome that under the current administration of Phil Murphy, and we now have some of the most progressive PFC drinking water supplies in the nation. And the state of New Jersey is now also going after the industrial operators that have been a cause of the PFC contamination in the drinking water supplies. All of that is to say, if we had had a green amendment in the state of New Jersey, we could have prevented the stymieing of the passage of these drinking water protection standards. We could have then also potentially, had we needed it, used the green amendment to press the government officials to go after those industrial operators that were the source of the PFOA contamination. You might liken that, right, to PCBs. If you had a green amendment in the state of Washington, I don't know all the ins and outs of what is actually happening here, but you can start to imagine if you did have a state agency that was sitting on their hands, that was not going after Monsanto to require, right, action and activities to address the PCB contamination problem, you may be able to find a legal hook to use the Green Amendment to force the government to take the steps necessary to secure cleanup, including either doing the cleanup themselves or going after those who are responsible for the contamination in the first instance, right? So all of that, right, it's always... It doesn't become an instant panacea, and I can't tell you how it will play out in every situation, but to the extent that we've got government involved in allowing pollution and degradation and harm to happen, a green amendment can be used to stop that action or activity, and to the extent that we have government officials that are sitting on their hands not addressing environmental contamination and degradation that rises to the level of being a constitutional violation, the Green Amendment can be used to spur on appropriate action and activity by government officials.
In the state of Washington, we have, as you know, we fought fossil fuels and proposals, and a lot of times what ends up happening is that we just work on getting a permit denied, and then we have, like, okay, they need a permit from the Department of Ecology, deny that. Well, now they need a permit from the DNR. Well, deny that one, and then we'll try and deny the one from the Army Corps, and so on and so on. And the tribes have played a big part in that, at least at the federal level. You know, we're working on that government part, but how is a Green Amendment going to just even kind of stop these kinds of proposals? I mean, why is it that companies are so powerful to be able to do this? And I know there's a lot of history involved in that, but you know, how can we make sure that a green amendment just even at least makes them think twice? It's like, well, we can't, we're, you know, we might even be denied the permits. We know that we're going to have that against us. But if we have this green amendment, do we, should we rethink about this particular proposal? Do you think that would help? Just even stopping companies, even without government having to interfere all the time or intervene all the time, and citizens.
So the way a green amendment helps in those dirty fossil fuel situations, right, is it actually does become the tool that helps you get the government to say no to the permit or the approval that allows the industrial operation to go forward. And if you get that enough times, right, you actually can start to stop the industry. And again, I can only use, in this kind of context, I can only really show people what we've been able to accomplish in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to, in a very real way, show how mm-hmm. a green amendment can make a difference. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, when fracking came to Pennsylvania, that was in the mid-2000s. That's when the green amendment was declared to be good public policy and did not have the legal strength that we restored to it in December of 2013. So the industry came in and was overriding its communities. Now that we have a legally live and vibrant green amendment, we can't instantly kick the entire industry out. We have to claw back the ground we lost. I believe if we had a vibrant green amendment first, we could have used the green amendment to keep that dirty fossil fuel industry out of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and Pennsylvania communities. Mm-hmm. But because the industry got there first, right, we now are having to show how the green amendment applies in varying contexts to prevent the advancement of that industry. And I believe ultimately will result in our being able to stop it in the state. Because absolutely, you cannot frack for shale gas and recognize and protect the constitutional right to a healthy environment. Fundamentally, the two are mutually exclusive. But we're having to make that case and prove that point permit by permit, piece yeah. of legislation or regulation after piece of legislation or regulation. But the thing with that 2012 piece of legislation that I told you about, that very pro-fracking piece of legislation, drilling and fracking was already overwhelming Pennsylvania communities under the state of the law at the time it was in 2012. But the passage of Act 13, that's that pro-fracking piece of legislation, the mm-hmm. Act 13 was going to mandate that drilling and fracking be allowed to happen in every part of every community in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, including in their residential districts, including mm-hmm. mandating that operating drilling and fracking well pads with their dirty toxic wastewater pits be allowed to be sited as close as 300 feet from people's homes. It was going to give the frackers the power of eminent domain to be able to force the storage of their explosive fracked gas under people's private property, right? Denying those private property owners the ability to say no. It was going to give automatic waivers from the environmental protections that were in place. So things were really going to get a whole lot worse if Act 13 had been allowed to stand. Through the use of Pennsylvania's Green Amendment, we prevented all of that new harm. Since that time, we have actually been using it in a permit-by-permit, community-by-community context to battle back these individual decisions. Again, whether they're permit decisions or what might be happening in a community to advance an ordinance, to battle back the advancement of the industry. And the goal is, of course, to prevent the harm that would happen on that particular site next to a school or next to a residential community, mm-hmm. but also in so doing, over time, be really making the case that there is no way for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to be approving these permits or for pro-fracking ordinances, extreme pro-fracking ordinances to continue to advance and allow the industry to go on and to grow. And in so doing, to sort of push the industry back, not to just hold it off, but to push it back. But that will take time. So because you already have the kinds of industries in place that you're talking about, that's how most likely in the first instance the Green Amendment will operate in the state. You'll have to use it case by case by case, not just permit by permit, but it might be over local ordinances, you know, pro-industry local ordinances or pro-industry legislation. But you'll be able to prevent those things that will help the industry to advance. And in so doing, right, you start to make the environmental and the economic, put in play the environmental and the economic context that actually starts to push the industry back out of the state, because they see that they're not going to be able to continue to advance, that it's not economically viable, right? And so it happens over time. That's right. So it's a really powerful, powerful tool, but it is not an instant panacea. And that is something that becomes hard to accept, even for me, you know, where we're mm-hmm. using this Green Amendment in Pennsylvania to know that it doesn't instantly kick that dirty fossil fuel industry out. But I know we have it as a tool to keep it from progressing, and over time to make the conditions such that it will eventually go away. We will be able to make the case to the Pennsylvania legislator and the governor, who is very pro-fracking, both of them are very pro-fracking, that you actually cannot allow the continuing advancement of drilling and fracking and protect the constitutional right to a healthy environment, that the only way you can do that is through clean energy creation, not dirty fossil fuel energy.
So if they had a permit that was up for review, you could challenge that in theory. You know, permit to start fracking or just continue fracking, you might be able to challenge that on the grounds that it was violating the right to clean air and clean water.
That's right. You would bring forth the science and the facts to make the case that if you allow drilling and fracking at that site in that location using this dirty industrial operation, that you will result in the contamination of water, air, or environmental degradation or devastation that would violate the constitutional right to a healthy environment. Or another way to do it, and this is the way that we have successfully used it in one permit context, be able to make the case that in approving the permit that allowed the industrial operation to happen in this particular location, that the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, the regulatory agency, failed to look at the science and the facts and the impacts before they said yes. Right? And because they didn't look at the impact beforehand, they actually could not constitutionally defend their decision to grant the permit. And we've actually had, in the energy context, but also in some other contexts having to do with factory farming, as well as some other toxic contamination contexts, that the inability of the government officials to demonstrate that they looked at the science and the ramifications of their decision forced them to actually pull back their permit and have to go do the work, right, that would demonstrate that they could protect the constitutional right to a healthy environment and render their decision. And in the context where we've had that victory, what we've seen is the permit, in some cases voluntarily by the agency, got pulled back, and then they just didn't continue to pursue it because of what the dynamics of this of the situation were. So it actually can be used to play out that scenario in a couple of ways.
So we just have a few minutes left, Maya. I want to briefly ask you, because you had mentioned this at the very beginning of the show. Why do you so strongly believe that we have to do this first at the state level before the federal level? And then what are the basic steps that people can do to start this in their state? We have to do this briefly, and then you can talk, you know, very quickly about your talk tonight in Sandpoint.
So it's easier to change a constitutional constitution at the state level than it is at the federal level. And in order to make a federal constitutional change, you actually need the support of the majority of the states. So by doing the work of advancing a green amendment state by state by state, we are actually building the level of public awareness and public support necessary to ultimately result in the state votes that would be necessary to advance a federal green amendment. But primarily, right, we can't hop to the federal level because we haven't done the work of informing people about this new powerful idea of how to protect our environment, why it's powerful, why it makes a difference, why people want to be supportive of it. We haven't done the work of letting people actually know that they do not have a right to clean water, clean air, a stable climate and a healthy environment. Most people believe that they actually do have that right and are shocked to learn that that is not the case. So, and also, when we get the Green Amendment at the state levels, right, it will impact all state government action and activity. So it will have an effect very quickly, upon what is happening in that state. But it doesn't displace the need for a federal Green Amendment because it won't apply to the federal government. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, if we have a federal Green Amendment, we will still need state Green Amendments because we need to have that control over what's happening at the state level. So it's more accessible, and in doing the work at the state level, we are laying the groundwork necessary to ultimately have a federal Green Amendment. And I think everybody could recognize if we tried to jump to a federal Green Amendment today, we would fail.
Too big of a leap.
Yes.
So we're doing the work. And the way you get a Green Amendment, every state's different, but here in the state of Washington, what you would primarily do is you would find some legislative champions that would propose a Green Amendment. That proposal would have to pass by a two-thirds vote in the state legislature, and then ultimately it would go before the people for a majority vote to advance it. And what I would say is if there are people here in Washington or, you know, any other state across the nation, if you want to be part of the Green Amendment movement, please get in touch with me, Maya@forthegenerations.org. Let me help you. Let me help you craft the correct Green Amendment language, take on the challenges, develop and advance the strategy, deliver the messages and the messaging, take on those false arguments against the Green Amendment, using the knowledge and the experience that I've built, but at the same time, teaching those communities what they need to know, right, to be able to advance, do the work they have to in their state to advance the Green Amendment, right? It has to be a team effort, and mm-hmm. I just want to be part of the team.
And you're going to be in Sandpoint tonight as a guest of the Lake Pendere Waterkeeper?
Yes, I am, and I'm going to be doing two other talks in... you're going to have to help me pronounce it.
Coeur d'Alene.
Right? I'm going to be at the Coeur d'Alene Public Library on Thursday, and I am going to... Bridget's telling me I'm being told I'm saying the wrong stuff. So, you know what? If you go to greenamendments.org, up on the events page, you can find all the information about where I'll be in Idaho over the next three nights, and I hope people will join me. But please, please, please come tonight. It would be awesome to see people.
All right. Well, we want to thank you very much, Maya, for this very interesting presentation and for your deep and thoughtful efforts. That is going to do it for our show today. You've been listening to Earth Matters Now on KORS 88.1 and 92.3. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! at 5. Counterspin is now on Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Check out programming online. And please donate to your community radio station, KORS. Have a great week, everyone.
President Trump's military threats against Iran strengthens Tehran's hardliners and weakens moderates. And Matoi Monroe of United American Indians of New England, who talks about a bill she's supporting that would replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day statewide across Massachusetts. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
China's leader, President Xi Jinping, may have a winning hand in confronting President Trump's escalating trade war with China. Xi made a recent well-publicized visit to a facility that processes rare earth minerals with an implicit threat that he could cut off the U.S. supply of these materials, which are vital to the global digital economy. Chinese-made permanent magnets, which incorporate four different rare earth elements to differing degrees, are used in various products, including earbuds, wind turbines, and electric cars, and China dominates their production. In 2010, Beijing used their dominance in rare earth materials as leverage in negotiations with Japan over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Foreign Policy magazine reports that China won a short-term advantage, but that the embargo drove other countries to reassess and reduce their reliance on critical materials that Beijing controls. Meanwhile, the Trump administration placed China's giant telecom company, Huawei, the world's largest developer of 5G mobile technology, on a Commerce Department list of companies seen as a national security risk, thus preventing it from leasing or buying U.S. technology. Full implementation of the ban was delayed for 90 days. Quickly, Google, Intel, and Qualcomm dropped contracts with Huawei. But the U.S. moves, meant to punish China, could accelerate the very Chinese policies the Trump administration has sought to derail. Hu Shijin, editor of the Chinese government-owned Global Times newspaper, says Huawei has for many years had a backup plan to prepare for a cutoff of Western technology by increasing domestic semiconductor and high-tech manufacturing. These policies, in fact, could hasten the erosion of U.S. dominance in the global chip market. In villages east of Cape Town, South Africa, the stark racist divide of the apartheid era